The whole process was so exhausting, and at the end of the day, I thought I was gonna win, and then I feel like it got taken away from me, and then I was coerced into something else.
Dominique Hewett is an actress. She was sexually assaulted by Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein. And like many other survivors, Dominique wanted Weinstein and the executives and board members surrounding him held to account. So she sued the Weinstein Company, alleging that the board of directors knew about Weinstein's predatory behavior for years and did nothing.
Just for them all to have to testify to what they did to allow this to happen for so many years and how complicit they all were and how they enabled abuse on women so this never happens again.
Dominique felt confident about her case, so she decided to bring the lawsuit as an individual. But then a judge ruled that it had to be part of a class action suit with other survivors. The judge also decided something else, that the case had to go through the bankruptcy courts.
Well, as soon as they filed for bankruptcy, I kind of knew it was going downhill.
Downhill, because of a tactic used by corporate executives to shield them from liability. It's called a non-debtor release. It essentially gives executives and board members immunity from civil lawsuits related to bankruptcy cases for life. And this liability shield has become a very popular practice in bankruptcy proceedings. According to a recent Reuters investigation, of 626 cases in the last decade, these non-debtor releases were used in 90% of them. And as you probably have guessed, they were used in the bankruptcy case against the Weinstein Company. Its entire board, which includes people such as publishing heir Dirk Ziff, the owner of the New York Knicks and the New York Rangers, James Dolan, and Weinstein's brother Bob, co-founder of the company, even Harvey Weinstein himself secured a liability release.
The non-debtor releases let the board of directors off the hook, and a lot of them are billionaires. And I felt like there was a much bigger picture for them to be held accountable because I believe they were complicit in letting this happen over and over again to so many women whose lives were damaged, that letting them get released was an atrocity.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Dominique Hewett was 10 years old when she first knew she wanted to be an actress. She loved telling stories and taking on different characters. She joined the local children's theater in Dallas, where she grew up. And when it came time for college, Dominique moved to New York City.
I just really thought I had a lot of potential because I went to some modeling contests and they really liked me as a kid. I had an agent here in Dallas and I went up for a couple commercials as a kid. And I just thought maybe if I moved to the big city, I could make it.
Opportunities blossomed once Dominique graduated from NYU. But then the Writers Guild of America went on strike in 2007, and work in New York City slowed down a lot. So Dominique decided to move to LA.
That's kind of where the story with Weinstein picks up because he was one of the first people I contacted out there because I knew he made things happen and he was winning Oscars and he was kind of the biggest deal in the industry at that time.
So Weinstein and Dominique agreed to meet up in November of 2010 at the Peninsula Beverly Hills Hotel in California to talk about potential work opportunities.
I was meeting him at the restaurant, so I had no idea he even was staying there or anything. I just thought we were meeting at a hotel. That was fairly normal to meet at a bar or restaurant. But things quickly escalated to him saying, "Follow me." He didn't tell me where we were going. He just said to follow him. So that at that point, I realized we were going up to a suite. And that was kind of standard at the time that meetings were happening in suites like that.
Dominique was 27 years old. She had just moved to LA and needed to work. And this was a work meeting. At least it was supposed to be.
That's when I noticed that he kind of had his whole room was set up where he had his initials on the sheets and it looked like he lived there. He didn't ask me permission to move, go up there. He just told me to follow him. So, of course, he was the one in power. I said, okay. And we were talking about films, but he also gave me a glass of champagne and he was like, drink this. And, everyone knows the story. He would ask for a massage and then just demand that you kind of go along with what he wanted to do. And that's the way it worked.
Dominique says Weinstein sexually assaulted her in that hotel room, an allegation Weinstein denies. Dominique was in shock, though, after that night. She didn't tell anyone, not even her friends or family, because she didn't know how.
So it felt coercive and it felt forced. And it's definitely not something that I wanted to do. And it just felt like this was the nature of the business. If he was the guy that you go to, it felt like this is what you have to do as a woman if you want to get anywhere.
Dominique wanted to block that night out of her mind and never see Harvey Weinstein again. She also wanted to keep working. But after that night, it became very difficult for her to find any acting jobs in LA.
I didn't realize that he was the type that if you rejected him, that he would blacklist you from the whole industry. So come to find out that that was his personality.
Dominique struggled financially and emotionally for years. So when the news broke in October of 2017 about Weinstein's pattern of sexual assault, Dominique and other survivors believed justice could be served both through the criminal justice system and through financial restitution. But as you heard earlier, her lawsuit was forced into the bankruptcy courts, and it got stuck there for years. Negotiations dragged on and on. But a settlement was finally reached in 2021. But the settlement included those non-debtor releases, protecting the entire board of the Weinstein Company and Harvey Weinstein himself. Dominique was outraged that Weinstein might emerge unscathed. So she filed a formal objection. However, the other 40 or so survivors did not object, so the judge approved the settlement.
I'm not blaming the survivors. I just think they really thought it was the best option, and it was one of the only options. It's kind of how the whole thing went down, was just awful and drawn out and exhausting. So I could see why people would just want to settle. That's kind of the goal that they do, is they drag it out so you'll be exhausted. And I just felt that I wanted to be on the right side of history, and I felt like opposing it was right for me.
Now, before the deal was signed, Dominique and some of the other survivors were given an option to personally sue Weinstein. But there was a catch. They had to use their settlement money to pay for his lawyer fees. Well, Dominique Hewitt says she does not understand how victims can be forced to give liability immunity to people like Harvey Weinstein. It just does not seem right, she says.
It's just very unfair that they continue on with their wealth and we're all still struggling, most of us, and have no career. So that doesn't feel like justice.
Well, Dominique Hewitt's story is just one of many that recent Reuters investigation highlights, that investigation which shows how non-debtor releases are proliferating in bankruptcy cases. Mike Spector reported the story. He is the U.S. corporate crisis correspondent for Reuters, and we have a link to his investigation at onpointradio.org. And Mike joins us now. Welcome to On Point, Mike.
Thanks for having me.
So non-debtor releases, a totally unfamiliar term to me prior to familiarizing myself with your reporting, Mike. Can you explain in more detail, like, what exactly are they?
So they're called non-debtor releases because they shield non-debtors. When a company or an organization files for bankruptcy, they're known as a debtor. They owe money to creditors. Those who are associated with them, so say the members of the board of directors of the Weinstein Company, they have not filed for bankruptcy. They're non-debtors. But they're able to sort of piggyback on that bankruptcy case. And not only does the debtor, the Weinstein Company, get a release in exchange for the settlement and the judge approving a bankruptcy plan, but so do these non-debtor members of the board.
I mean, how does that work? Because are those folks, the board members, the executives themselves, because they are not the corporation, right? I mean, are they even in the bankruptcy filings? So I don't understand how they get dragged into the whole picture of the bankruptcy case.
It gets into complicated legal minutiae, but essentially they're what's known as related parties. And the way that judges typically approve these things is by looking to a section of the bankruptcy code that allows them to do what's necessary for a bankruptcy reorganization. In this case, it was a plan of liquidation in the Weinstein case for it to succeed. And there's controversy about whether they should be allowed to do that, but the rationale is these boards of directors gave up about $10 million of money to pay for their legal fees from insurance policies that they were entitled to. And because they did that and the insurers kicked in money for this $17 million settlement that was reached, they would not do that if they still would be sued after the bankruptcy was completed. So hence, in exchange for that money, they get a non-debtor release and they can't be sued again.
Okay. You know, bankruptcy law is quite detailed, Mike, so you're going to have to forgive me if I ask a lot of basic questions here. Who's actually paying in these cases? I mean, is it the insurance companies, like you said?
Yes. So taking the Weinstein case as an example, since we're talking a lot about that, what happened there is the insurers agreed to kick in some money to the bankruptcy state of the Weinstein Company that would help fund this settlement for survivors. And it was about $17 million at the end of the day for roughly 50 women who filed claims in the bankruptcy court. But an insurance company doesn't want to do that if those survivors are just going to turn around after the bankruptcy and sue them to try to get damages out of their pockets again. And they also wouldn't do it if they had to follow the letter of their policy in detail and pay these boards, these members of the boards of directors. So the combination of all of that and that money getting kicked in is what allowed them in part to get these releases.
I see. And so then the conclusion of that process that we're focusing on is that people such as Harvey Weinstein secure immunity from civil suits for life in these cases.
That's exactly right. Lifetime liability shield.
Okay. So when we come back, Mike, we're going to talk about how all this happened. So stay there with us. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about non-debtor releases. They're a tactic used in bankruptcy court that ends up providing immunity from liability in future civil cases for executives and members of boards of corporations for life. And they are proliferating in bankruptcy court, and we're trying to understand why and how that is happening. Now, this reporting comes to us from Mike Spector. He's the U.S. corporate crisis correspondent at Reuters, and we have a link to his investigation on non-debtor releases, and that link is at onpointradio.org. Mike, before we dig in deeply into what you found in terms of how common these non-debtor releases are now, I'd love to hear a little bit of the story about why they even exist in the first place. Certainly at some point in time in bankruptcy law, there was a belief that they were that these non-debtor releases were serving a purposeful function.
So the short answer is asbestos. So in the 1980s, Johns Manville filed for bankruptcy, overwhelmed with asbestos lawsuits. And as they went through that reorganization, it was determined that they faced this uncertain future where lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit would keep getting filed. And there was a latency period with the cancer linked to asbestos known as mesothelioma. So people, decades after exposure, would get sick and they'd file a lawsuit. So Insurance companies contributed hundreds of millions of dollars to settle all of that litigation, but one key was also to settle all future litigation. So to just create a trust, put a bunch of money in it, and say, hey, maybe you haven't even discovered you're sick yet. Maybe you haven't filed a lawsuit yet, but if you wake up 10 years from now and you get a diagnosis and you file a lawsuit, well, wait, no, you can't file a lawsuit. But you can get some compensation, go to this trust. Mm. And in exchange for that, the insurers got non-debtor releases. They didn't file for bankruptcy themselves, but they were a related party in the Johns Manville bankruptcy. So they got shielded from all future litigation and everybody was steered to a trust. But then what happened is everybody started using it for other purposes. Congress in 1994 amended the bankruptcy code, changed it to provide that non-debtor releases could be used in asbestos cases. But as we've seen in the Weinstein case, and you mentioned earlier the Purdue Pharma case with OxyContin and wealthy members of the Sackler family who owned that pharmaceutical company, non-debtor releases are now being used in contexts that they weren't originally envisioned to be used for.
Okay. So a couple of things there. So first of all, it makes sense that the insurance companies in the case of asbestos would seek some sort of, you know, future release from liability. But at the same time, there was that trust, though. So people, if they came into future terrible suffering due to asbestos and lung disease, there would be some way for them to be compensated. That's the idea, right?
That's the idea. And that's the pattern that you see in almost all of these bankruptcies with non-debtor releases, is that these lawsuits get channeled, that's the term, channeled into a trust. Where the controversy arises is some claimants say, hey, I don't want to be channeled into a trust. I want to have my day in court. I want a trial. I want a deposition. Like Dominique Hewitt said when you interviewed her at the top of this show, I wanted members of the board of directors of the Weinstein Company to testify. So part of the controversy here is that these plaintiffs become creditors in a bankruptcy against their will. They get swept into it, and then they're dealing with bankruptcy law and bankruptcy judges, and these releases shield entities or people they wanted to sue to hold responsible for their alleged harm.
And excuse me, in exchange, there isn't necessarily a similar trust like we saw in the asbestos case.
Usually there is some kind of trust. Yeah. Where the sort of controversy arises is that Congress very clearly said that's okay in asbestos cases. Asbestos is sort of an exceptional circumstance that Congress decided, okay, like, this is out of control. We need to give companies this type of relief. What's happened now is other companies are using non-debtor releases to protect boards of directors and executives. Sometimes large companies themselves are just creating entities and putting them into bankruptcy. We saw that with Johnson & Johnson and its baby powder lawsuits. And then without filing for bankruptcy themselves, they want to seek a liability shield. So we see it being used in other contexts. We should mention that the J&J allegation deals with asbestos. So that's there's allegations of asbestos in the baby powder, which J&J, of course, denies. So that's a bit of a more nuanced legal issue there. But, you know, in the Purdue Pharma case, a district court judge tossed that bankruptcy plan and said, the Sacklers can't get non-debtor releases in this bankruptcy because Congress said this should only be for asbestos, not to get immunity from opioid lawsuits.
Okay, so we're going to come back to that in a minute here, Mike. But I just want to now turn to, in more detail, what you found in your Reuters investigation. You looked at, more than 600 cases over the past decade. And you found that 600 bankruptcy cases, I should specify, and that you found non-debtor releases in 90% of them. Did that surprise you?
It didn't surprise me a lot, actually, because what sparked this investigation was our coverage of the Purdue Pharma case. And I've covered bankruptcy for a long time, and I've come across these releases in cases before. And they're usually in the context of the debtor under bankruptcy protection getting a release as part of their reorganization plan. And that's a pretty kind of regular practice. But then you would see some related parties, too, also getting these shields, getting these non-debtor releases. So I thought to myself that if we looked at a bunch of cases, we'd probably see them a lot. And, of course, we did. And not every bankruptcy is a Purdue Pharma or a Weinstein company or even like a 3M earplug situation, for instance, which is another case with their Aero subsidiary going on right now. There are a lot of routine bankruptcies where these non-debtor releases get handed out to shield directors and executives and other related parties from what might be allegedly frivolous litigation or lawsuits about how the restructuring was handled or how money was handled. They would get handed out all the time. And what's happened now is because they're so common and judges are so willing to grant them, big corporations are taking advantage. So we separately examined 29 bankruptcies that involved mass tort litigation, tons of lawsuits, and we found non-debtor releases in all of them and more than a million claimants either signing their rights away with non-debtor releases or facing that prospect as the bankruptcy process goes on.
Okay, Mike, hang on here for just a second because I want to bring in Clifford White III into the conversation. He's an attorney who led the U.S. Trustee Office, known as the watchdog of the American bankruptcy system, and he was director there for 17 years, where he helped litigate on issues such as third-party releases. Mr. White just retired this past March. Clifford White, welcome to On Point.
My pleasure.
So tell me, what was the U.S. Trustee's office's position on non-debtor releases as a tool to be used in the bankruptcy system over the 17 years that you were director there?
We were pretty consistently opposed to these non-consensual third-party releases. And principally, for a very basic fact, the bankruptcy code does not allow it. And there's no, in our view, and in my opinion now, continues to be, the law doesn't allow it. Bankruptcy courts shouldn't permit it.
The law doesn't allow it. So help me understand that more, because as Mike said, he said Congress passed regulation that says it can be used in asbestos-only cases. So is that the limit of the statutory basis that you see?
That is, and it can properly be used in asbestos cases under very specific prescribed procedures and protections that Congress put in. And it's being used beyond that. And as Mike said earlier, and as his story points out, the idea of the asbestos provision was so that there could be double dipping. The insurance company wouldn't be sued on what really would be, not to get too much in the weeds, a derivative claim. But instead, it's being used not for a derivative claim, the kind of claim that comes from exactly what the debtor itself could seek recovery from the insurance company on, but it goes to direct claims, a property right owned by a victim, such as a parent of a child who overdosed on opioids, and that parent thinks that the Sackler family ought to be held accountable. The asbestos statute doesn't provide for that, and the fact that Congress acted on the asbestos statute shows it didn't intend for these releases to be used in other contexts.
Okay, so you're going to have to forgive me a little here, because we do these stories sometimes that once the details start becoming clear, I'm just aghast at how these things actually happen. So Clifford White, I mean, you're exactly right. I'm hearing you say that Congress was affirmative in what in the limits that it saw that these non-debtor releases should be used, because as you say, they clearly said yes for asbestos cases, right? The implication being no for other forms of cases. So if there is indeed no statutory basis for any other use of non-debtor releases in bankruptcy court, why are judges allowing it to happen?
Well, I think from a legal perspective, they would say they have some residual authorities and some elastic authorities within the code that we don't think exist. When I was director, and we continue to have this position, the Department of Justice continues to have the position that although our heads would be beaten in to oppose these, as judges would continue to approve them, we persisted, and I think we're beginning to show the emperor has no clothes. We recently won the appeal in the Purdue Pharma case. It's now on appeal up to the circuit court, but the bankruptcy court was reversed. The same thing happened in the Ann Taylor bankruptcy case months ago in the Eastern District of Virginia. So some progress is being made. When these cases started proliferating, the justification used and still is used, they're rare, only in rare and necessary cases. Otherwise, the deal would fall apart. They quickly became the norm. And now, one judge critical of the practice recently said they're nothing more than participation trophies.
Mike Spector, nothing more than participation trophies. What do you think of that?
So, yes, Cliff's absolutely right. There was a judge who called them participation trophies. I believe he also referred to them as merit badges. And he was very critical in a case he was overseeing and noted that, you know, oh, these boards of directors really wanted and needed these releases because they had worked so hard on this reorganization. And he said, well, you know, like boards of directors at companies that aren't in bankruptcy also work very hard. They would probably like liability shields also, but they can't get them. So, yes, what's happened, what we found is, you know, over the years, judges are kind of handing these things out. And they get handed out, and lawyers for debtors and non-debtors request them routinely. Just to kind of get them as sort of a reward for completing the reorganization. And, you know, you can understand that if you were on a board of a company in bankruptcy facing litigation, you'd want that release, right? You'd want to go to bed at night when that bankruptcy is over and know that you're not going to get sued again. But as Cliff mentioned, and as the district court judge in Purdue Pharma found, there's really only explicit authority for granting non-debtor releases in asbestos cases, and there isn't explicit authority in other cases. There's a raging debate about that in bankruptcy circles right now. There's another section that I referenced earlier and that Cliff alluded to, Section 105, that is elastic, as Cliff mentioned. It's sort of like the necessary and proper clause, if you remember that from studying the U.S. Constitution. It's like the necessary and proper clause of the bankruptcy code that lets judges do things that are necessary for reorganization to be successful. And the judges basically agree with arguments from lawyers for companies and entities in bankruptcy that, like, hey, you know, the Sacklers are going to take their $6 billion and go home if they don't get a liability shield, and then this thing will liquidate and all of the victims will get less money than if the Sacklers wrote their check for $6 billion. And so that's why these things end up getting approved the way they get done.
Yeah, okay. I'm glad you made that point. So Clifford White, let me turn back to you here. In addition to what Mike said about sort of the possibility of victims getting nothing, I'm wondering if from the insurance company's point of view, you know, in many of these cases, the ultimate entity that would be paying out the money, do they not see the non-debtor releases as sort of like the bankruptcy court's form of preventing double jeopardy, right? Like basically having to pay out twice for the same malfeasance or the same bankruptcy court issue?
Well, I'll let the insurance companies speak for themselves. They probably would say they'd have a lot of defenses if they're going to be separately sued. We're talking about where there's a separate direct cause of action, somebody's right to sue. So Dominique wasn't saying that she simply wants to turn around and sue the insurance company. She was saying she wanted to press her grievance, her legal right, against other third parties who weren't debtors. And if those third parties don't want to be subject to that lawsuit, they have recourse to the bankruptcy system too. they would have to file their own bankruptcy case, and they don't want to do that. You can speculate why. Perhaps it has something to do with the fact that when you go into bankruptcy yourself, you have to make full disclosure of your finances. You have to give up most of your non-exempt assets. That's what hundreds and thousands of our fellow citizens do, wage earners, when they are in financial distress and need relief from their debts. But the executives, the insiders, are getting the protection without meeting their obligations under the bankruptcy code, the obligations that your average wage earner has to satisfy.
Well, today we're talking about the proliferation of what's called non-debtor releases in bankruptcy court. And they're being used by companies, by boards of executives, by executives themselves, I should say, to eventually secure immunity from future civil lawsuits. So we'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
I'm Kathleen Goldhar, and I'm the host of a new podcast, Crime Story. Every week, we bring you a different crime told by the storyteller who knows it best.
You got one witness who can't be found. You got another witness who's murdered.
We couldn't sugarcoat this story.
I was getting calls from Cosby's attorney threatening to sue every day.
Every crime in one way or another is a reflection of who we are as a people, as a city, as a country.
Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Smart journalism, fascinating topics, words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. I want to give you a heads up on a show that we're working on for next week because we need your input on it. And it has to do with the fact that the Census Bureau has data that shows that Americans are spending fewer hours per week with friends than we did a decade ago. Now, you might think this is because of the pandemic, but this is actually a trend that started well before the pandemic. We're just not spending as much time with friends, okay, not just online, but with friends as we were a decade ago. So we want to hear from you. Has that changed, happened in the pattern of your life? Are you spending less time with your friends than you once did? Why do you think that is? Are you making more of an effort to sort of claw some of that time back? And what has that lost time with your friends done in your life? What impact has it had on you? So let us know. You can do that two ways. One, via the On Point Vox Pop app. If it's not already on your phone, just go to your app store and search for On Point Vox Pop, and you can send us a really high-quality message that way. Or you can also call us, regular old phone, and leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Remember, we're going to talk about the reduction in time that we are spending with our friends in this country and the impact it has had on all of us. Now, today we are talking about so-called non-debtor releases being used quite frequently in bankruptcy court and the effect that it's having not only on claimants or plaintiffs that are seeking some form of justice, but the fact that it ends up shielding executives and board members of major companies from future civil liability for life. Now, this story comes to us from Mike Spector. He's the U.S. corporate crisis correspondent at Reuters, and we have a link to his reporting at onpointradio.org. And Clifford White joins us as well. He just retired this March after 17 years as director of the U.S. trustee office. Now, Mr. White, there's a couple of questions I want to ask you and Mike about really the choices, if any, that the claimants in these cases have. And then thinking back to Dominique's case, you know, she did have the opportunity to object to the settlement that included the non-debtor release. So just sort of superficially there, Does that not give adequate options for people who do eventually sort of, as Mike said, want to have their day in court with these companies and executives?
Well, no, that's not adequate at all because there's nothing in the law that allows the debtor or the bankruptcy court to give her that Hobbesian choice of either agreeing or not being able to participate in the bankruptcy case. The U.S. trustee's position of longstanding has been a debtor, a third party, a victim, must give an affirmative, knowing, and informed consent. They must opt in. And if they don't, you cannot take their property right away. A debtor cannot negotiate the rights away of the rights of a non-debtor against another non-debtor. I think that if this ever goes to the Supreme Court's going to take that position too.
So that you just anticipated a question of mine because I keep coming back to if the rules are so clear around this, how does this keep happening? And I guess what I'm hearing you saying is that it just needs to have some sort of definitive ruling by, I guess, the ultimate court in the United States, by the Supreme Court. Is that what you're saying, Clifford?
Yes, I think so. I think it's got to, we've got to get an ultimate resolution. The district court in New York that reversed the bankruptcy judge in Purdue Pharma said that there needs to be some final resolution of this. It's been going on for a long time. The basis, the statutory basis for what the bankruptcy courts are doing is very thin. And there's a little more traction now than there was a few years ago in terms of bankruptcy courts being reversed. Yeah. So I'm hopeful that this can get up there because it is not fair that a victim has to give up their property rights in order to participate in a bankruptcy plan.
Mike, can you tell me about the details that you found in your investigation about this particular issue regarding what victims are asked to give up as the settlements are adjudicated? Because, I mean, Clifford just said consent is required, but it sounds like in many cases it actually wasn't.
Yeah, so what happens is judges kind of gloss over the objections if the settlement is supported by enough claimants. So in the Weinstein case, there were about 50 women with claims in that case. And there were four objections. And the judge in that case said, you know, I'm hearing loudly from these other survivors that they want this $17 million settlement. They don't want to go through an uncertain process of litigation against third parties. They want to take this money, have some kind of closure, and move on with their lives. Someone like Dominique Hewitt is saying, hey, you're taking my right away, as Clifford alluded to, without my consent. And that's illegal. That's not allowed under the bankruptcy code. And to your earlier point about, you know, what type of leverage claimants might have or rights that they have, you know, they're represented by counsel and the debtor pays for that counsel representing a creditors committee and they can vote against the plan. But the problem from their perspective, they would say, is they get swept into the bankruptcy without their consent to begin with. And yeah, they can oppose the plan. They can object. They could all vote no on the bankruptcy plan, and the debtor would have to go back to the drawing board to try and draw something up that they would want to give up their legal right to agree to. But the longer they object or resist, the more money gets paid to lawyers and other professional fees, the estate gets drained, and there's less money for them in the end. So, you know, big corporations and powerful executives and directors, they're perfectly happy for these bankruptcy cases to drag on for years until they get some kind of deal that victims feel like they have to take that puts a cap on their liability.
Right. I'm really glad you said that, Mike, because this is something that we had been discussing in our editorial meetings, that there's sort of a financial imbalance here in terms of the corporations just having endless amounts of money to let these cases drag on, right? So, but Clifford, walk me through a hypothetical here. Let's take the Weinstein case that Dominique was involved in here. Suppose the judge and the lawyers in that case behaved exactly within the statutory bounds of what non-debtor releases can and can't be used for. What would the settlement ideally look like? Would it be the kind of thing where, the four people who objected were just allowed to have their objection, the settlement goes forward, but then they get to bring future suits? I mean, what would it look like?
Yes, because it's an individual right they have, a majority of other creditors cannot take away that right from them, and the debtor cannot take that right away from them. So they should be able to pursue their lawsuit if they don't consent and still participate in whatever recoveries the plan is making available to them. Let me make another point that I think is important because it is often cited by courts in approving these non-debtor releases. While overwhelming majority of creditors approve. Well, when you take a closer look, you'll see that oftentimes only a small minority of creditors ever vote. Mm. And in the Purdue Pharma case, it was about 20%. So it's probably a minority of creditors. But even if it were the majority, they cannot eviscerate individual rights.
Yeah. You know, also just from the perspective of a layperson and not a bankruptcy lawyer or a bankruptcy judge, I think it's quite challenging, or it's a formidable task for a claimant to even understand what they are being offered or what they are potentially losing in these settlements. Mike, that's kind of what it feels like to me. I don't know if that's actually the case.
Yeah, I think, look, bankruptcy cases are tough for the layperson, and they usually end up with competent counsel advising them. They have to rely on those lawyers to tell them what to do. And these bankruptcy plans can be hundreds of pages. Even the ballot that you get can be several pages, and it can have impenetrable legalese throughout that a layperson is not going to really understand, and they're going to have to rely on their lawyers. And where the controversy arises here is, these lawyers are sort of going along with what the judges want, and they're objecting at times, but, sometimes they lose those objections. They get overruled. So a layperson sort of finds themselves sort of being told that, like, hey, this is the money on the table. You should probably take this. I don't think it's going to get any better than this. And what we've been talking about here with these releases not being allowed, well, there's no finality yet from the Supreme Court on whether they're allowed or not.
Right.
And the debate rages and judges make different decisions. So, a victim is sort of caught in the middle of all that.
Yeah. So just to recap here and to be clear, short of, like you said, finality from the Supreme Court or action by Congress, which we'll talk about in a second, I just do want to be clear that judges themselves, they don't have to allow these non-debtor releases in the settlements, right?
Yeah. I mean, you sort of took the words right out of my mouth there. I mean, that was the next point I was going to make. The third option, the third leg of the stool was judges could make different decisions. Judges could be more like Judge Wiles, which is the judge that Clifford alluded to earlier, who called non-debtor releases participation trophies, and say, no, you can't do these.
Hmm. Now, I should note that Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren has introduced legislation that would clamp down on the use of these non-debtor releases, severely curtail them, I should say, and also require, what we're talking about, like fully knowledgeable consent by folks in these cases if the non-debtor release is used. The idea has received some opposition in Congress. For example, here's Republican House Representative Scott Fitzgerald of Wisconsin during a hearing on this bill back in November of 2021.
Third-party releases are more likely to be approved when they increase settlement funds that plaintiffs ultimately get, or when litigation risks outside of the bankruptcy context could leave some plaintiffs with less of a recovery, or perhaps a similar recovery, but significantly delayed. tying the hands of bankruptcy judges and preventing their consideration of proposed bankruptcy settlements that include these types of releases may lead to unintended consequences for plaintiffs. If this bill becomes law, it will make the difficult task that bankruptcy courts have even harder by taking away some of their current tools to get equitable relief.
So, Clifford White, respond to that, because it seems to me that Representative Fitzgerald is saying, well, if we take away the option of using non-debtor releases, it could actually delay justice or delay relief, as he says, for victims themselves.
Well, in some cases, that might be the case, which is why sometimes victims will vote for it. But that's really not the point. I don't agree with the proposition that one should give bankruptcy judges wide leeway without having statutory guidance from the Congress. Actually, that doesn't seem to me to be a position Republicans usually take, to have judges unmoored from the bankruptcy statute. So if Congress wants to intervene, it would, in passing a law allowing in some way third-party releases, it would have to provide for due process protections like the asbestos statute does, detailed procedures. It would have to limit the scope of the releases. It's very questionable whether under the Constitution you can deny the day in court. And very importantly, define consent, because bankruptcy judges are all over the map on these issues. If you consider justice meaning that like facts will be decided in the same way, that's justice. I think we get away from that, and we don't have that when judges make such disparate decisions based on similar facts.
Huh. Mike, what are your thoughts about the proposal from Senator Warren and the pushback you heard there from Representative Fitzgerald?
So this legislation was inspired by the Purdue Pharma case and the non-debtor releases being proposed for members of the Sackler family, who own the company. And as you've seen, there are disagreements about it. And there are also a lot of other big issues circulating through Washington right now. Foreign assistance to Ukraine in their war, repelling the Russian invasion, inflation, just to name a couple. So it doesn't appear at the moment that this legislation is getting a ton of traction, but Democrats in control of committees have been holding hearings about this, and we'll have to watch and see how it progresses. But at the moment, it doesn't seem right now like there's a lot of hope of bipartisan support for a reform to this issue.
Is it possible, because I think you both mentioned that the Purdue Pharma case is under appeal, is it possible that that could make it all the way up to the Supreme Court, say, before any legislation comes out of Congress, Mike?
It's entirely possible. Depending on how that case goes, the loser could certainly appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, and then it would be up to the Supreme Court to decide whether they want to hear that case. Lots of times, the Supreme Court will just decline to hear a case, and so the appeals court decision will stand. So we'll have to wait. All eyes are on the Second Circuit right now.
Yeah. Well, Mike Spector's reporting, his investigation, I should say, is called How Corporate Chiefs Dodge Lawsuits Over Sexual Abuse and Deadly Products. And we have a link to it at onpointradio.org. And Mike is the U.S. Corporate Crisis Correspondent for Reuters. Thank you so much for joining us, Mike.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And Clifford White III, who just recently retired as director of the U.S. Trustee Office. He served in that position for 17 years as the watchdog of the U.S. bankruptcy system. Mr. White, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.